The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anika Gal from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the August Glamour Magazine and the July 13 Thursday Styles issue of the New York Times. Today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached at kiwanisfoundation.org. Well, welcome back, everyone. The August issue of Glamour Magazine is all about random acts of courage. In fact, I'm going to be just quickly editing the editor-in-chief's letter at the beginning of the Glamour Magazine August issue. And she says, editing this issue reminds me we are all braver than we think. And she says, much has been made of how many women may avoid taking risks because we're more afraid of failure than men are. As war hero and public servant Tammy Duckworth once observed to this magazine, quote, when men running for office lose a race, they think the electorate made a mistake. When women lose, they think they suck at politics. For that reason, it's powerful to remind ourselves that everyone fails all the time, and life goes on. Duckworth herself lost her first race for Congress, but then ran again and won. You may now address her as Madam Senator. But it's also powerful to remember that we're probably gutsier already than we give ourselves credit for. Risks, after all, come in all shapes and sizes. Make your own list of accomplishments and then sit back and be impressed by it. Life is available for a limited time only, subject to change without notice. And, this is the good part, the sole responsibility of the recipient. That would be you. And that's an edited version of her letter, Cindy Lev, the editor-in-chief. All right, so let's talk about some of these random acts of courage. One of our first articles just asks some people, what's the biggest risk you've ever taken? And Alfrodita Dorado says, going to a concert in Paris with my best friend at age 16. We had enough money for the flight and tickets, but not the hotel. It was so fun. Kenya Kinsky Jones says, competitive horse jumping. Every time you get on the horse, it's a risk. So when it works, it's the most beautiful thing. And finally, Ebony Davis says, moving to New York with barely any money, but it was right for my career. Melissa Mears, who wrote the tribute to Lilith Fair in this magazine this month, says, I've been on crazy backpacking trips and accepted jobs in which I had zero experience. But honestly, the answer is probably having kids. Best decision of my life. All righty. And then finally, Erin Treib. She says, because I photograph in regions of conflict, I take big risks regularly. It's scary, but the idea of looking back and thinking what could have been is much more frightening. And Paloma Elsesser says, I left college and decided to give my modeling career my all. Now I'm getting educated in ways college couldn't offer, but I do hope to finish school one day. And lastly, Lisa Eldridge says, starting my YouTube channel, it really was not the thing for a professional makeup artist to do at the time, but I believe strongly in the future of digital, so I took a leap. All righty. So Here is a story in the well-being section, and it shows three images of the same young woman. One is a little bit, maybe has a little bit of extra fat around her torso area, and that was taken February 2013. The next one, the middle one, she's quite slender, and that was taken October 2016. And finally, kind of in between the two, she's smiling, and that was taken March 2017. The article is entitled, What Before and After Pictures Don't Tell You. Side-by-side images of weight loss are addictive to scroll through, but let the women in them tell you what you can't see. And this is as told to Barry Lieberman. It was never about having a perfect body, says Joanne Encarnacion, 33, from San Jose, California. And that is the woman who is pictured above, who I was describing to you. Before and after photos have become a full-on social media phenomenon. But these kinds of images can never really show you a start point and an end point to anyone's weight or health journey. They're just part of a story, often a lifelong one, with ups, downs, and U-turns. Glamour asked three women with widely viewed before and afters to share the real deal on their personal odysseys and what they learned that we all should know. About 4 years ago, I set out to lose the 20 pounds I'd put on during my second pregnancy. My older daughter had told me I looked beautiful, and I'd responded, No, I'm not. I'm fat. The photo above, on the left, was taken around that time, and that was the one that I described as her having a little bit of maybe extra fat around her torso area. I couldn't believe I'd said that to her, and I didn't want to go on feeling like I wasn't taking care of myself. So I started making sure I was moving more each day. I cleaned up my diet, and I lost the weight. I felt good, and I wanted to see what I could do next. I began working out harder, doing more strength training, and eating even less. I didn't take rest days. When I posted my after photo, the middle one, people said I was an inspiration, which should have been motivating for me, but I was not happy, at least not in the way I wanted to be. I had no balance in my life. It's heartbreaking to look back and think that I couldn't enjoy playing with my kids because I was so concerned about the love handles I thought I had. So last year, I changed my views. The most important thing I realized isn't my weight. It's staying true to who I am. I have stretch marks. I have loose skin. I'm never going to be perfect. When I shared this part of my story, it turned out that my, quote, failure was even more inspiring to people. Sure, on my latest photo, which was the last one that I described, which was kind of in between the, you know, first one and the second one, some people have said, so you got fat. But that's okay. I bounce back because I know I'm the happiest I've ever been. I can cope with my anxiety. My marriage is stronger. I'm a better mother. And I found a new career path as a health coach. I spend more time with my kids, and I'm present for it. To the negative commenters, I say, fitness doesn't have to be one thing. My goals aren't to get more and more defined or lose weight. I want to be fitter and happier as a whole. I've learned I can't evaluate fitness using someone else's definition of health. And you can't evaluate someone's health by looking at a photo either. No one's opinion about my body matters besides mine. I lost sight of what's important. It's not how I look, it's how I feel. And Amanda Roberts, 24, from Temecula, California, writes, I didn't think I'd still be dealing with criticism. About a year after I had my daughter in early 2014, I reached my heaviest weight of 330 pounds. I had back pain, and I wasn't able to be the mother I wanted to be. So under the advice of my doctor, I received bariatric surgery. After about 18 months, I lost 150 pounds. I had all this excess skin, so much that I thought I'd done something wrong, because no one else was talking about this part of their weight loss. I later realized it's entirely normal. Because I'd started with unrealistic expectations, I decided to document my journey first on Tumblr and then Instagram at MANDAS_MUFFINTOP, hoping that my photos, like the two above left, which are showing her in January of 2017 with the sagging skin over her abdomen, hoping that my photos, like the two above left, would make other people feel less alone. It was painful. When I was plus size, people told me I was unhealthy and looked terrible. With these pictures, some people made fun of my loose skin, saying things like, "Your stomach looks like an old man." After I got surgery to remove the excess skin, I thought that would be the end of the criticism. But now people come at me asking how I could be body positive if I've had skin removal surgery. I did it to improve my quality of life. I don't have to worry about moving my skin around to sit. Of course I'm body positive. How else could I put myself out there like this? Sometimes I think it would be easier if I shut down my Instagram, but then I remember the positive feedback I've gotten. My followers tell me they feel more comfortable in their body because of me. I want people to love themselves no matter what stage, before, after, or in between they're in. And finally, people body shamed me. Michelle Spindler, 32, from Boise, Idaho. And there's a picture of her in July of 2015. You know, normal weight and all that, normal size. Looks like she's normal sized for her. And then March of 2017, where she is substantially thinner. Until 2 years ago, I was a smoker. I drank and I didn't eat well. I was a crash dieter and would look in the mirror and put myself down. I wasn't happy with where I was emotionally, and I'd heard working out could help with that. Then I found Kayla Itzin's community online and was inspired by the supportive women there. I signed up for her plan and went from years of not exercising to logging 6 workouts a week. I was stronger and treating myself with more respect. I was proud of what I had accomplished, so I decided to post some before and after photos, which were those that I had just described, far left from my dieting days and left after I started working out. The next day, Kayla featured my photos on her accounts. I was ecstatic until I read some of the comments. People said I looked better before, I looked sick now, and I must be unhealthy. For 2 days, I obsessed about reading the posts. I was so confused and hurt. I knew I had made healthy changes in my life. I reminded myself that people didn't know that I used to eat poorly, drink, and smoke. I focused on the mental progress I've made, too, something people can't tell by looking at the photo. One person implied I was romanticizing anorexia, but later reached out to me and apologized. She said she didn't realize I was a real person. I thanked her. That apology meant a lot to me. People will always say judgmental things. I'm not doing this for them, but for me. Well, it does take a lot of courage to make any changes in one's life. And this next article is going to speak about some very courageous women. It's under the talk section of the Glamour magazine 2017 August issue, and it is called Life with ISIS and After ISIS. For nearly 3 years, women in Mosul, Iraq, were stifled by terrorist rule. Photojournalist Erin Trieb met them as they broke free. And there's a picture of three women with their hijabs on, completely covering their faces. Only their eyes can be somewhat seen. And then that's on top. And the bottom picture shows, and that's Life with ISIS. And then where it says, and after ISIS, there are two women who have their hijabs on, but their entire face can be seen. Whereas the previous one, their faces could not be seen, only their eyes slightly through a very thin sheath. Miami, near right, and Hoiran on their phone 10 days after liberation. And the top, the girls with Hoiran's mother dressing the way they were forced to under ISIS. Hardly any acronym strikes more horror in American hearts than ISIS, ISIS, the extremist group that boasts of bombing teens at concerts, driving trucks into holiday crowds, and beheading journalists. But in 2014, when most of us were first learning of ISIS's signature savagery, women in Iraq were already well acquainted. The militants were at their door. It was June of that year when ISIS captured Mosul, a city of 2 million, that's the second largest in the country, in a move intended to establish a caliphate, or Islamic State. Virtually overnight, according to reports, its gunmen roamed the streets, and religious police lurked in the alleyways. Women, who had worked as doctors and dentists and freely gone to school, were forbidden from studying and allowed outside only if shrouded in black cloth. Every speck of skin, including their eyes, covered. A forgotten glove or veil was suddenly punishable by beating with a stick. Many families lost their livelihoods and their men to prison. Phones and the internet were banned. Worse, these injustices were shadows of a much darker violence. ISIS has been a horror story, man, said one woman who managed to flee the city. We'd see corpses cut in two on the street. It was normal for children to play with several with severed heads. They've turned our neighborhoods into ghost towns. Nearly 3 years later, the terror lockdown has taken its toll on Mosul's civilians. Iraqi forces rallied to liberate the city last October, but the situation remains deadly. At press time, the massive liberation operation was still inching along, with U.S. air support winning block by block, even as ISIS soldiers staked themselves out in people's yards, using the families as human shields. When photojournalist Erin Trieb, 35, arrived in Mosul for Glamour in mid-March, neighborhoods were erupting in gunfire and bombs screamed from the sky. Residents were terrified that ISIS would come back and retaliate. But Trieb wanted to know what it felt like for women to taste their first moments of freedom. These women's stories were so much more harrowing than I expected, she says. They had hit rock bottom, were starving to death, traumatized, and yet, defiantly, they survived. Here she tells the stories of three women just beginning to enjoy their independence. We thought we'd burned alive. On a block of crumbling houses in West Mosul this spring, I met two cousins, Miami Fares, 18, and Hoiran Adnan, 16. I saw the girls waving from across the street, motioning me over. They invited me in for tea and began telling me what life was like before ISIS. Miami had been in school, and Hoiran stayed at home with her parents. Both girls loved to dance and take selfies. When ISIS came 3 years ago, we learned quickly there were no jobs, no schools, no work, Miami's mother told me. Hoiran and Miami spent their days inside. Going out could mean being confronted by militants. They can cut your head off if you do anything wrong, Hoiran said. And this was no exaggeration. I learned of many families whose relatives were beheaded for breaking ISIS's rules, like owning a cell phone. But when the cousins did leave the house, they would often lift the black veil that concealed their eyes if they thought they were safe from militants and the Hizbah, the ISIS religious police. If I got scared, Miami said, Hoiran would tell me, ISIS won't do anything to you. They can go to hell. The more we spoke, the more I realized how courageous these girls are. It's uncommon for teenage girls in Iraq to speak their minds freely. Hoiran and Miami were fierce, as were their opinions. In February, the Iraqi army finally reached their neighborhood, but liberation did not come quickly. ISIS was positioned in their front yard. During the fighting, the family took cover in a basement for 10 days. We thought they'd burn us alive, Hoiran said. When I met the girls, it had been only a week since they'd come out. Their neighbors were throwing a party. As they played music, sang, and danced for the first time in 3 years, every act of freedom felt new. We let out 3 years of anxiety, said Miami. Hoiran said, laughing, we can't even describe it. While life without ISIS means a return of certain liberties, the cousins know there are still limits. Even now, if I want to visit a friend or walk down a street alone, my family won't allow it, said Miami. But a boy can do whatever he wants. Why is it like this in our culture? We want to remove these restrictions. We want to live a normal life. Ghofran Amar Diab, 19, had been walking all night when I met her. ISIS came and destroyed our lives, she told me. You should have seen the state we were in, the hunger, the poverty. The worst of her ordeal had started almost half a year earlier. At 5 months pregnant, she'd traveled with her husband from her village about 20 miles outside Mosul into the city for a maternity checkup. While he waited outside the clinic, fighting erupted. When Ghofran came out, people were running everywhere. Amid the chaos, she shouted her husband's name but could not find him. Ghofran went from street to street, knocking on doors, asking for help. Finally, a woman named Sahar took her in. I lived in Sahar's house for 4 months, thinking I'd never see my family again, Ghofran said. With ISIS forbidding phones, she could not even call them. Everyone at the house suffered from food shortages. My only meal each day was tomato paste I mixed with water, Ghofran said. I just cried. That's how hungry I was. Toward the end of her pregnancy, starving and desperate, she and Sahar's two young sons ventured out and found a house occupied by ISIS militants. Once it was empty, Ghofran smashed a window and crawled inside. The only food she could find was a packet of powdered drink mix. She grabbed it and ran, but first she sought revenge. I just started smashing their dishes, throwing things out of the window, even flipping over a table out of spite, she said. It was difficult to imagine this tiny girl raging against her persecutors. The packet she stole contained 10 grams of orange-flavored sugar, which she made last 4 days. When I asked if she'd been afraid, she said, "Not one bit. I was happy to destroy their belongings." When Ghofran's contractions started, Iraqi forces were bombing ISIS positions nearby. Warplanes flew overhead. Unable to get to a hospital, they hurried to Sahar's sister's house a mile away, where a neighbor assisted with the birth, cutting the umbilical cord with a kitchen knife. I was in so much pain I couldn't think, Gaffron said. The baby weighed less than 3 pounds. Gaffron named her Naba, the great news. Gaffron and Sahar had tried to escape their ISIS-held neighborhood before, but they had run into snipers. The families ahead of us were killed, she said, so we turned back. 10 days after Naba's birth, they tried again. This time, after walking hours in the rain, they made it to safety. Gaffron was so weak that Sahar's daughter carried the baby. I met Gaffron as she was almost home. She had not seen her mother for 4 months. ISIS had imprisoned her father and likely killed her husband. But her mother was anxiously waiting. Gaffron had kept herself and her baby alive amid immense chaos and hardship. When I asked how she had endured, she said her reason was Naba. I wonder how she came to life under such danger. It was a miracle. She is our hope. Erin Treib at Erin Treib photographs women's issues in the Middle East. To help women in Mosul, go to rescue.org. And there's a quote here. I want Naba to go to school so she can choose whatever she wants to become, says Gaffron when Glamour checked on Naba in June. She was thriving. A lot of courageous women. And we're going to be talking about some more and a lot of other cool things next week, the 31st of August. But for now, we have come to the end of our program. So we will hopefully see you next Thursday. We have run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Annika Gal, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleradioreadingservice.org. Today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached at kiwanisfoundation.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.